Thanks so much for joining us today. The sun is out. Good news there. Also very good news, Tom Schroyer back in studio. And just moments ago, we were talking about the last Minnesota Law show we worked was at the State Fair.
Hard to believe. Oh, my. A beautiful, sunny August day. And I think we've got the great wind machine going today for that Gopher game tonight. It'll be out of the northeast for those folks sitting on the home stand side. That'll be a lot of fun.
That's right. Well, outdoor football. The elements are back in play. A football game tonight, of course, Michigan State in town. Because we have an evening football game, we're on the air. Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. And it's been a while as well for Kevin Bush. He hasn't been in studio in quite some time, and it's good to see Kevin.
It is indeed. Kevin has been here a number of times, as you know, Steve, as the chairman of our commercial law department at Moss and Barnett. Kevin is a commercial lawyer, which means he has purview over any in all manner of commercial legal matters. And Kevin is, we call Kevin our lawyer's lawyer. He is a student of the law, and he's very, very scholarly and erudite. And so, Kevin, welcome back. Great to have you here on our program.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be back.
We are tackling a topic today of gargantuan size and scope, the Uniform Commercial Code. If Kevin's holding up a booklet, it's how many pages?
300.
300 pages of fine type text of statutory language dealing with the gamut of commercial activities in this country. And it's really hard to overstate the importance of the Uniform Commercial Code.
We thought we should start with a scary topic for Halloween. And for lawyers, there's not much more scary a topic than the Uniform Commercial Code. And we probably should start with the disclaimer that this has nothing to do with the blue suit uniforms that lots of lawyers like to wear. This is the Uniform Commercial Code. And we probably should start with a little moment of silence here. I think most of the lawyers in the audience are probably at this point snickering or groaning because for most lawyers, the UCC brings back memories of a class in law school and a handful of questions on the bar exam, all of which they'd really rather forget.
Well, as a matter of fact, I think this is the only program we've announced that we have gotten some raised eyebrows on from our colleagues wondering how in the world can you folks cover a subject like the Uniform Commercial Code or the UCC, as lawyers refer to it. But I think the answer, Kevin, lies in the fact that not only is it the backbone of commercial law in America and an amazingly important and pervasive force, but it also affects the lives of individuals and business owners directly and on a daily basis.
It is. I like to think of the UCC as being similar to the foundation of a house. We don't see the foundation very much, and what we do see really isn't much to look at. But if the foundation is doing its job right, it provides a solid footing for what's going on up above. And the UCC is the same way. We are all using the UCC, most of us several times a day, but we don't even know it. But every time I buy something at the store or over the Internet or even from a vendor down at the mall or my neighbor's garage sale, the UCC governs that transaction. Every time I write a check, every time I borrow money, every time I rent a car or a piece of equipment, or if I ship or store goods, all of those transactions and many more are covered by the UCC.
And it's really, the UCC represents a bit of a departure from the way that our law has normally or historically developed. We're a common law country, after all, following in the tradition of Great Britain and the other common law countries where our law is made by typically judges who decide one case after another. But the UCC represents a break with that pattern.
It does, and we'll try to get our hands around it in a minute. But the concept of a code is to take a relatively narrow area of the law and then write a set of rules, a set of procedures that will apply to everything that goes on in that area.
We should let our audience know that we are not going to cover everything in the UCC on this program, but rather today's show is going to be an introduction, an overview, if you will, and then we'll follow up with Kevin Bush in subsequent installments on particular subparts of the UCC of particular interest to our audience.
I think to get our hands around it, maybe we'll take a look at the three words that make up the title, uniform, commercial, and code. Look at each of those separately, and then we can perhaps look at some examples of how it affects us on a daily basis.
Sure. So we're going to start with the first word in the title, which is uniform. What does that mean?
If people think about it, we have 50 states in this country, plus a handful of special territories, districts, and commonwealths. We have a little over 3,000 counties. We have countless cities and towns, and actually a good number of sovereign Native American communities. If each of those jurisdictions created its own laws regarding commercial transactions, it would be hard to do business across a state, much less across a country. And so the Uniform Commercial Code is intended to create a set of laws that will be uniform or nearly the same across the whole country.
Why couldn't the federal government just step in and impose this?
That is certainly an alternative, but it's been hard for the federal government to come up with well-crafted commercial legislation. And historically, it just isn't the way these sorts of laws have been addressed.
So was the driver behind this statute the need for uniformity across state lines and throughout the U.S. and
yes.
its territories?
Yes.
It's along the lines of time. Once upon a time, every town, every jurisdiction had their own timekeeper, and then standard time was created. Same sort of thing.
It is similar to that. An example we'll use in a moment is if I write a check, I might mail it to somebody in Chicago who deposits it at a bank in New York. It's very important that that check have the same sorts of laws at each step along the way.
Sure.
One of the things we have to recognize is even though it is uniform, that doesn't mean it's identical in every state. There are variations. Some states will experiment with certain parts of the UCC, and some states haven't adopted all parts of it. But in general, I know that if I have a transaction that crosses borders, the basic rules will be the same in each spot.
And at a minimum, you know where to go to look for it.
Correct.
And in Minnesota, the Uniform Commercial Code is found in Chapter 336 of the Minnesota Statutes.
Correct. And depending upon which printed version one looks at, it's 300 pages or 400 pages long. That's the one I carry around with me most of the time.
Now, do I need to read that before the next time you visit, Kevin? Do I have to bring that home?
I think that's going to be part of the test for the second break here. I have a version of it on my desk at the office that's about 2,000 pages long because it has some commentary and historical context. And then in our library, we have a complete set that's about 100 volumes of all of the history and cases that have been developed under this statute over the years.
Now, I know that we've listed or we have linked our website to the Uniform Commercial Code at www.moss-barnett.com.
We have, and if anybody wants to read it, it's some of the most carefully written language ever in America, and it's been in process for quite a few years.
And it is a guaranteed cure for insomnia for first-year law students.
Well, it keeps me awake at night.
Right.
Now, the UCC is also uniform in a different way, and that is it's uniform across quite a few different types of parties and transactions. For instance, if I go into a hardware store and buy a one-pound box of nails for a home improvement project, that transaction is governed by the UCC. But if my contractor goes in and buys the big 50-pound contractor box of nails at the store, that transaction is also covered. And if the hardware chain goes to the nail manufacturer and buys, say, 1 million pounds of nails for all the stores nationwide, that transaction is also covered. So same statute, same language for three very different types of transactions.
So it's uniform at various levels. Both it applies to consumers and merchants and manufacturers.
And yes, all those and for big transactions and very small ones. And then finally, it's uniform over time. It with a statute like this, it's important that it not change very much over time because my forms and procedures and personnel training would have to change every time the statute changes. And the main part of the UCC was written in the 1950s, and some of that has not changed at all in the intervening 50 years.
We'll have to credit Professor Carl Llewellyn and his wife, Sonia Menshikoff, for being the principal authors, as I understand it, of the code.
They were. In some ways, was a one-person show back in the 1950s when this was written.
We have more on the way. The Uniform Commercial Code, Trick or Treat. Kevin Bush in studio, Tom Schreier, our host. It is Minnesota Law, and of course, any topic on Minnesota Law, either today's show or past shows, available online at moss-barnett.com. Click on the Minnesota Law icon. Podcasts and other legal information from all our past shows can be found on our Minnesota Law web pages. We have more coming up in a moment here on News Radio 830 WCCO. Welcome back to Minnesota Law. We're back in studio today. Go for football tonight. When there isn't a football game, we come your way each and every Saturday at noon. Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett. Tom Schreier, our host. Great to see Tom and great to see Kevin Bush. Today, the Uniform Commercial Code Trick or Treat. We talked about uniform. How about commercial?
That's next in line. This is a little confusing because it sounds as if we're making a distinction between consumers and business, and we're not. Because both consumer and business transactions are covered by the Uniform Commercial Code. And with commercial, we're talking about related to commerce, everything that involves moving goods and money around in our national economy is part of commerce, and that's what's covered by the Uniform Commercial Code. Now, there are some important exceptions or exclusions to this. For instance, real estate is almost entirely excluded from the UCC.
Why would that be, Kevin? Why wouldn't they just wrap it all together in the same package?
Real estate law developed in its own tradition and often at a very local level. Real estate, of course, doesn't move across state lines, so there wasn't anywhere near as much importance to have it be uniform from state to state. Now, in a historical quirk, services also aren't covered, which can lead to some odd circumstances. So, for instance, if I go to a store and buy a couple of gallons of paint to paint my house, that paint transaction is covered by the UCC. I'm buying goods. But if I hire this painting job out and the painter provides this paint as part of his project, that paint is not covered by the UCC because it's part of a service. Some very fine distinctions, that's what the UCC has in many places, is distinctions, sometimes artificial, because we have to draw the line someplace.
You mentioned that this was first written in the 1950s, and a lot's changed since then. Does the UCC apply to software?
Software is one of the most difficult areas for the UCC because it didn't exist when the UCC was written. Several years ago, some of the smartest people in the country in the legal field spent about 10 years trying to come up with a way to bring software into the UCC. They were completely unsuccessful, and no statutory change occurred because of that, even though they spent a lot of time, a lot of effort. So what we have right now is software and many other transactions, service transactions, that are not covered by any particular statute. And instead, we're back to what Tom talked about earlier, a common law where the judges need to make up the rules based on historical precedent rather than a series of carefully written statutes.
So at the end of the day, what we have is a as you describe it, a foundation of commercial law. It must be working pretty well because we hardly ever hear of it in our daily lives.
It does work well because it was very carefully thought out over many, many years. And most of the time, the transactions go ahead without a hitch.
And so as I understand it, the philosophy behind the Uniform Commercial Code was to adopt a framework or a foundation, as you say, for how commercial transactions are supposed to work, but without dictating every little detail.
To answer that, let's go to our third word, which is code. What is a code?
All right, and we're about up to our break here, so maybe we want to hold off on that for a bit, but we'll be circling back to that after the break. As I understand, we're about to head into the news hour.
We have the news and weather coming up momentarily. Tom Schreier, our host, Kevin Bush, in with the Uniform Commercial Code, Trick or Treat. Why is it so important, and how does it impact the day-to-day life? That is coming up. We'll have much more on Minnesota Law. By the way, go online. You can go to moss-barnett.com, click on the Minnesota Law icon, podcasts, and other legal info from all our past shows can be found on our Minnesota Law web pages. That's moss-barnett.com. Once again, the news and weather coming up next, then more Minnesota Law here on News Radio 830 WCCO. Minnesota Law is back. We come your way each and every Saturday at noon when there's no football game. Football game tonight, Minnesota and Michigan State. Tom Schroyer back in studio as our host, Kevin Bush, on the topic of the Uniform Commercial Code Trick or Treat. We've learned about the words uniform and commercial. What about code?
Well, all of us have had some familiarity with the Internal Revenue Code. We have to deal with that at least once a year. Some of us, or many of us in popular culture, were introduced to the Pirates Code by Johnny Depp, where the concept was it's not really a code, but more a set of principles.
For pirates.
And in some ways, the UCC is that way. It is a very detailed statute covering lots of questions at a level of minutia that is hard to appreciate until you actually read it. But what we find is the code has to be full of relatively loose terms. So we see the words good faith. We see the concept of reasonableness. We see the word conspicuous. All concepts that are built into the UCC to give it some flexibility, to give parties and judges the opportunity to make it fit particular transactions.
Now, that's been a bit controversial, though, Kevin, has it not? Because It implies that there's some wiggle room, some way for people to get off the hook, so to speak, of their deals or to imply deals where and terms where none existed. And lawyers in particular have been a little frustrated around that.
That's true, but there is no way to write a code with enough detail to cover every possible situation. As soon as we try to do that, a fact situation will come up that fits right in between two rules that we've created, and we need to give the court or a jury sometimes the opportunity to come up with a fair answer that fits the particular facts that are presented.
So the trade-off is some measure of additional fairness and flexibility versus sort of the school of hard knocks or tough luck if we had some hard and fast rules that couldn't be varied ever.
Correct. And the UCC has both. It has some very hard rules, and sometimes they are applied in a very rigid fashion because they simply have to be.
One of the terms that you mentioned that has always flummoxed me is the notion of good faith. I mean, after all, aren't we all acting in good faith here, and what does it mean?
It actually is defined in the UCC, but it's defined in such a way that when read carefully, it says good faith means good faith. And it's an opportunity for a court to say we know people need to act fairly, and we're going to require that of everybody involved in a UCC-related transaction.
Now, so is that to say that every contract or every commercial relationship governed by the UCC is subject to a condition that the parties act in good faith?
Yes.
And if they don't, that can lead to ramifications?
It can. We end up with a fair amount of litigation over the question of whether a particular action, a particular step was taken in good faith.
You know, and I know that especially non-lawyers find this to be a hard concept to get their mind around, but in fact the law does not look at a breach of contract as something that's immoral, as in we're breaking a promise, but rather it's just we're looking at a commercial transaction in a different way.
What the law tries to do is provide a remedy for a breach of contract. The remedy is not tied to the question of whether it's morally right or morally wrong. It's a matter of finding a good solution so that the parties have their expectations met.
And, in fact, doesn't the law at times encourage parties to breach a contract?
I don't think we'd ever say we encourage a breach of a contract. We recognize that in certain circumstances it is better from a public policy standpoint to not perform a contract precisely according to its terms, but to perform it in accordance with a good faith, reasonable approach.
Now, we are going to talk, I know, about an umbrella kind of an approach here about some of the areas of our common life that are touched by the UCC code, which is, after all, very widespread, very broad, and as you mentioned, an interesting combination of both being very specific and also very flexible and loosely worded.
Right.
So where would you like to start?
I think I'll start with checks, if we can. We've all heard recently about our paperless society and how we're going to not use checks anymore. And in fact, electronic transactions are much more common than they used to be. But we still write billions of checks, and that's with a B, in this country every year, involving trillions of dollars. And it's kind of an amazing concept if you think about it, because I'll take a cheap piece of paper, scribble a couple of words and numbers on it, sometimes in a handwriting that's almost impossible to read. That check will go through four or five different parties, and magically money gets transferred from my account to somebody else's account. And almost all of them work. It's amazing that any of them work, actually, with that arrangement. But of the billions of checks that get written, all but a very small fraction of a percent work just the way they're supposed to.
I remember once back in the, I think it was the 70s, watching a Johnny Carson Tonight Show where he had a guest on who wrote a check on a body part and presented that for payment, and that worked.
It can. A check does not have to be in any particular format. The reason the check system works is because the UCC provides a very carefully thought out, very carefully written set of rules for how the relationships of the parties will work as that check works its way through the system.
Now, what are some of the common problem areas that arise with checks that are governed by the Uniform Commercial Code?
Let's take a look at a few. One is an area called the stop payment order. Now, I know that if I write a check and I lose it, or I write a check and then realize I really wish I hadn't written that check, I can send a note to my bank for a small fee, and the bank will put a stop payment order on that check so that when it appears at the bank won't pay it. And that feels pretty safe until I realize for myself that that check itself is still a live instrument. It is a little mini contract with all kinds of rights and obligations associated with it. And if that check falls into the hands of particular parties, I will have to pay it even though I put a stop payment order on it. And this is where the code has introduced a very special fiction called the holder in due course. And this is a fiction created by the UCC to protect parties who handle checks, because parties need to be protected if the system is going to work. And against those types of parties, really no defenses work.
And so you have to be careful even after issuing a stop payment order to your bank to make sure that you retrieve the check.
Correct. A classic example of where this happens is, say I have some handyman who comes to my house and does some work. Maybe it's dark by the time he's done, and I give that person the check, and I go out the next morning and I realize that the person didn't really do the work. That check, I have it out there, and I call my bank, I put a stop payment order, but in the meantime, the handyman's gone down to a check cashing service and has cashed that check and is long gone. In the hands of the check cashing service, that check is still enforceable, and I will have to pay the check cashing service because in almost all cases, that check cashing service will be a holder in due course with these very special rights, even though I was defrauded into issuing that check.
Speaking of stop payment orders, I know that I myself, and I think most people, want to get a cashier's check when we're doing a private party sale of a car or something very valuable to make sure that we're going to have funds sufficient to cover the check. But can a cashier's check be subject to a stop payment order?
Cashier's checks present a particular problem these days, not so much because of the stop payment orders, but because there are any number of counterfeit cashier's checks that are in circulation. And they look good. They are completely they can't be distinguished from genuine ones, and yet they are completely fake. And people will trust them, but they will turn out, if I deposit a cashier's that fake cashier's check into my account, I'm actually responsible to reimburse my bank for that money when it turns out that the check is fraudulent and was counterfeit.
A real trap for the unwary there.
And that's because, every one of these checks is a little mini contract with built-in contract provisions, including warranties.
Now, in general, let's first introduce the topic by explaining to our audience what is a warranty.
Well, most of the time, a warranty is considered in connection with a sale of goods, and we'll get to that in a minute.
As in, I have a new car warranty that covers repairs, et cetera, for a certain number of miles.
Right. But a warranty generally is just a promise. And with every check is a series of promises imposed by the UCC. Nothing's in writing, but there are a whole series of promises. One of those is a warranty that this check is real.
It, meaning what?
Meaning that it is not counterfeit and that it will be paid when it is presented.
And so there, I'm warranting that I have enough money to pay it?
And if I've withdrawn the money from my account after I deposited this check, the bank will insist that I re-deposit that amount into the account to cover that counterfeit check.
So a simple piece of paper has very complicated implications behind the scenes, and maybe that's why we're seeing more and more businesses at the most basic retail level say, we're not dealing with it anymore. We're not accepting checks. Fast food, gas stations, a number of retail establishments have said, we want no part of this anymore.
Yeah, and many institutions have required electronic transactions as a safeguard against check problems. But again, we still issue billions of checks every year in this country.
Still points up the issue, as Steve is getting at, that was discussed last week or 2 weeks ago with John Rossman, and that is the availability of credit for people. If they can't get electronic credit cards or debit cards, it's going to be very hard for them to deal with the commerce going forward.
We have to take a break. We're going to come back with more. Tom Schroyer is our host. Kevin Bush joining us in studio. The Uniform Commercial Code Trick or Treat. We've got more on the way. We'll talk more about warranties as well here on News Radio 830 WCCO. It is Minnesota Law. It comes your way on Saturdays at noon when there's no football. We'll be back in November here on the program. By the way, a happy Halloween. Today, Tom Schroyer, our host, Kevin Bush in studio, the Uniform Commercial Code Trick or Treat. Quick reminder, be sure to go online, moss-barnett.com, click on the Minnesota Law icon. Podcasts and other legal info from all our past shows, including info from today's show, can be found on our Minnesota Law web pages.
Steve, we were talking with Kevin Bush about the Uniform Commercial Code and had just wrapped up a discussion about the warranties that come with a check. Now, we also know, Kevin, that warranties are made available by people, manufacturers and sellers of goods and other articles that we buy in stores and over the Internet. Does the UCC also govern those warranties?
It does. The UCC provides a set of basic warranties, even if there is no contract, written contract out there. Mm-hmm. And, of course, manufacturers and dealers have seemingly an unlimited number of variations on the warranties that they offer, with respect to which, on the consumer level, there is some federal overlay that we're not going to talk about today, separate from the UCC.
So consumers who are in transactions get some additional protection from federal law?
They can, yes.
Okay, so we're talking now just about the Uniform Commercial Code at the state level.
Right.
And what kind of warranties are applicable to the sale of goods there?
Well, let's take a look at three different points in the transaction. The first point we'll call is the acceptance level. That's where the goods are delivered, either at the store or maybe when I get them at the door at home. At that point, we apply what's called the perfect tender rule.
So let's make it, maybe take a time out. Let's envision a particular transaction. Can we envision perhaps a refrigerator being delivered to the home after we bought it at the store?
Right.
Okay, so we're at the home. The truck's pulled up in the driveway. They're bringing this big crate in, and they're just crossing my doorstep. Now what happens?
Well, maybe at that point I realize that the front of the refrigerator is blue instead of off-white. I don't have to accept it.
Okay.
The perfect tender rule says I can require that the goods being delivered are exactly the way I want them to be.
So I can order that refrigerator returned, and I get all my money back, or I get another one delivered?
Correct. Now, the fact that we have that right doesn't mean we have to exercise it all the time. There may be things that get delivered that aren't exactly what we want, but they will work just fine.
Well, now, here's the real issue in my household. I remember on one Thanksgiving, that was we were getting the refrigerator. It wasn't conforming, but the issue was we had to have it for the food that day.
Well, then we run into a problem. If I don't accept it right then, if I send it back, obviously I don't have the goods.
Right.
If I accept it, take it into the house, then I have accepted it, and now we move to a different category, which is the revocation category. But there it's not a perfect tender rule. It's called substantial impairment.
So I still had a chance to return the refrigerator, even though I'd used it?
You can, as long as it's done within a fairly short period of time. Now, the code doesn't say how much that time is. Again, it has to be reasonable. And that's anywhere from a few days to a few months, perhaps. But at that point, the impairment, the defect in the product has to be substantial.
So what if it's the wrong color? Would that be a substantial defect?
Could be, depending upon what – if you're trying to match something in the house and it is even just a little bit off, that might be a substantial impairment.
But perhaps a scratch on the bottom or the backside wouldn't be an issue?
Might not be enough to allow us to send it back.
All right, so now we're past that. I've accepted a non-conforming good. It perhaps has an insubstantial scratch, but then something later happens that perhaps the thing burns out.
Well, then we're into the warranty phase, which can extend for a long period of time. The basic warranty period in the UCC is 4 years. By contract, that can be restricted to shorter periods of time. And there we have a couple of different types of warranties. The most important one in the UCC is it's a warranty of merchantability, a big word that doesn't have a particularly good definition, but it essentially means that the goods are pretty good. They work. And or we may have other warranties that the manufacturer has given us. The most important thing here is that we act quickly. If I think I have a warranty problem or I have a substantial impairment, I need to let the seller know, because if I wait too long, the seller may actually be off the hook completely.
All right. Thank you, Kevin. As our audience can appreciate here after this hour, we have a lot more to cover on the Uniform Commercial Code, and we look forward to having you back.
I'll be glad to be here.
There he is, Kevin Bush. Tom Schroyer, our host. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Don't forget to go online, moss-barnett.com. Click on the Minnesota Law icon. Podcasts and other legal info from all our past shows can be found at moss-barnett.com. Enjoy the day.